Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, the radio show about ideas, this week with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a radio show with an agenda, which is to gently promote the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean things like freedom of expression, free inquiry, scepticism, the scientific method and secular humanism. You are, however, as likely to find us talking about the antithesis of these ideas, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, totalitarianism, censorship and conspiracy theory. Each edition of Little Atoms features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring in ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And tonight's show features an interview with the neuroscientist David Eagleman. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law. He is best known for his works on time perception, synesthesia and neurolaw. He's also a fiction writer, and his most recent book, which we talk about in this interview, is Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. David, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me today.
My pleasure.
Let's talk first of all about your new book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. 40 short stories, vignettes about possible afterlives, I suppose is the best way to describe it. So tell us where the idea came from.
Yeah, the idea behind the book is that a lot of people have a lot of certainty about things. So for example, on the one hand, you've got the atheists and you've got brilliant people like Dawkins and Dennett and so on writing books saying, essentially, we've got it all figured out. We know what's going on out there. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have people who are religious and commit to typically their parents' religion, whatever their community has taught them. But there's very little going on in the middle ground where people say, you know what? We have no idea what's going on. We really don't know what's going on out there. And it's surprising to me what a small voice that has in the literature. And so one of the areas of interest to me is sort of making up stories in that middle ground, because that's how science actually proceeds, is people make up stories and then you see what's going on. So that's essentially the idea that led me to write this book. This book is 40 mutually exclusive short stories all about, they're all set in different possible afterlives. And the whole book is meant as a joke. None of the stories are meant to be taken seriously, but what is meant to be taken seriously is the exercise of shining the flashlight around the possibility space and thinking about different possibilities and thinking about what might be going on. And so, to my knowledge, it's the only book that's structured this way, where it gives 40 answers that are all mutually exclusive, meaning that the meta message of the book is that we don't really know what the answer is. And so doing it this way also simultaneously gave me a playing field for examining human nature and the joys and complexity of life. And so the book, you know, fundamentally it's literary fiction about our lives and how we search for meaning.
It reminded me most of almost philosophy, like the 40 short thought experiments.
That's right. And for those who haven't read the book yet, the stories presented cover a variety of possibilities. So in some of the stories, God is a married couple that's getting a divorce. And in another one, God is the size of a microbe and doesn't actually know that we exist because we're on the wrong spatial scale. All his constituents are microbial. In others, God is a species of small, dim-witted creatures that have built us to solve the questions that they couldn't, and so on. In other stories, there is no God, and everybody is fighting over their own version of his non-existence. So it gives a real broad playing field for exploring ideas, and people have called it philosophiction, or
that's a good quote. It's philosophiction.
Yeah. First, it sounded like some venereal disease to me, but I think, anyway, and thought experiments, prose, poetry. It's been called all kinds of things. And what's been amazing to me is, what's been absolutely amazing to me has been the reception of this book, because both atheists and religious people really like the book, and apparently everybody in between. And that's been amazing, because I've gotten really glowing reviews from both ends of the spectrum, and I don't actually know of another book that's done that. The religious crowd really surprised me. It got on, one person posted on their list of top 10 spiritual books, because he said it really stretches the mind and the spirit and makes you think about different possibilities. And I thought that was wonderful, because I was afraid some people would be offended, those people who have, you know, certainty about their answers. But as it turns out, they like it, and atheists like it too. I've got a great quotation on the front of the book from Philip Pullman, who's an atheist, and everybody just seems to find something in this book that they can sink their teeth into, because as you said, it's about ideas. It's about taking an idea and sort of chewing on it and extrapolating it.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I presume, you know, you've not, unlike perhaps some of the more certain books at the new atheist end of the spectrum, you've not necessarily written this book to set out to perhaps change people's minds. But presumably, in this book, there is something for everyone. There's although most of the stories perhaps mention God or the idea of God, but there's never any that actually particularly follow stories of the major religions or anything. They're all your own invention. So I can see why you might think that religious people might not necessarily want to approach it. But in some ways, making people think about the issues is more likely to, you know, more likely to make people come to some conclusion themselves than just hectoring them and saying, you're wrong, you're wrong.
That's exactly right. It's not meant to change anybody's mind, except in the sense of asking them to think about the vastness of the possibility space. So, to my mind, this is what a life in science leads to, is an appreciation of the vastness out there. And I'm actually surprised by people who are not in science when they say, oh, well, you're a scientist, you must be an atheist. And I think this, you know, this shows the power of people like Dawkins and Dennett and so on, who have written just gorgeous, brilliant books, but unfortunately, they've given the wrong public perception about what it means to be a scientist. And so to a lot of people in the public, it means, okay, if you're a scientist, it means you're really smart and you figured everything else out and there's no room for any other story. So that's bullshit. So it turns out when you walk to the end of the pier of science, when you spend your life in science, what you realize is how little we know. And you end up with less certainty than you started with. And in fact, this is how science always proceeds. Somebody asked me, they said, is writing a book like this compatible with your scientific career? They said that in a very skeptical, demeaning way. And I said, you know, it is the heart of a scientific career. This is how we proceed. We make up stories that are different from any of the stories that are on the table. And we see, you know, we then see which ones are correct. We see which ones the weight of the evidence support. Now, there are some stories for which you just can't gather evidence. You don't know if the weight of the evidence supports it. And something like what we're doing here and if there's an afterlife is a perfect example of that. I mean, it's easy for people in science, it's easy for most of us to say, okay, like you just shut off and that's the end of it. And maybe that's right, but maybe it's not right. Things are always surprising to us. And in every generation, scientists have felt like, okay, we sort of have all the rules now, and now it's just a matter of putting the you know, carrying the two and finishing it out, and then we've sort of got it. But of course, it's laughable. In every generation, we look back and we say, my God, they didn't even know about electromagnetic radiation or quantum mechanics. Yeah, so every time we look back, that no one has ever had, it's never been true until now, so I'm not sure why it should be true now.
Presumably, there is a link between the ideas you're exploring in the book and neuroscience as well, because it's a subject where there's a particular lack of empirical evidence, you know, right across the board. So obviously ideas of faith come in, and that's the, you know, for the religious side, but also presumably for the atheist side as well. But presumably there's a root of where this need to believe in an afterlife comes from. Almost all, if not all, civilizations, since we've been able to formulate thought, have come up with ideas of an afterlife, despite the obvious and always continuing lack of any obvious empirical evidence. So where do you think that comes from? Is neuroscience qualified to look at those ideas, do you think?
It's a great question, and neuroscience is totally unqualified. And that's exactly where the heart of this book is, you know, I spent my entire life as a neuroscientist, and in the end we as a community have nothing to say about this. So that's part of what this book is about, is there are domains beyond the ken of science. It's beyond our toolbox. As scientists, what we do is we entertain multiple hypotheses, and we see what the weight of the evidence supports. And so we end up favoring the story that has the greater weight of evidence to it. That's what we do daily, and it's just been tremendously successful as an endeavor. We've cured smallpox that way, we've gotten ships to the moon, we've invented the computer, and so on. But there are many situations in which we have multiple hypotheses, but there is no evidence that favors one over the other. And what we have to do in that scenario is just hold them all in our heads at once and just be comfortable with that uncertainty. That's the terms of the agreement we have with Mother Nature. We tend to think arrogantly as scientists most of the time that, okay, we're just going to crack every problem, and maybe even within our own lifetime. But it seems to me at this point very unlikely that within my lifetime we're going to have some sort of understanding about what life and death is about. And so even though I'm a great fan of the scientific endeavor, and I will continue to do that, and I hope that my children and great-grandchildren do, you know, it will continue to move us forward, but there are many things that are just beyond the toolbox of science, certainly in my lifetime and maybe for the next, maybe forever.
All right, well, as these stories are all nice and short, could I possibly ask you to choose one to read for us?
Sure, that would be my pleasure. How about I'll read the title story some. In the afterlife, you relive all your experiences, but this time with the events reshuffled into a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. You spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on a toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean it's always pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months looking for lost items, 18 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom, staring out a bus window, sitting in an airport terminal, 1 year reading books. Your eyes hurt and you itch because you can't take a shower until it's your time to take your marathon 200-day shower. 2 weeks wondering what happens when you die. 1 minute realizing your body is falling. 72 hours of confusion. 1 hour realizing you've forgotten someone's name. 3 weeks realizing you are wrong. 2 days lying. 6 weeks waiting for a green light. 7 hours vomiting. 14 minutes of pure joy. 3 months doing laundry. 15 hours writing your signature. 2 days tying shoelaces. 67 days of heartbreak. 5 weeks driving lost. 3 days calculating restaurant tips. 51 days deciding what to wear. 9 days pretending you know what is being talked about. 2 weeks counting money. 18 days staring into the refrigerator. 34 days longing, 6 months watching commercials, 4 weeks sitting in thought, wondering if there is something better you could be doing with your time, 3 years swallowing food, 5 days working buttons and zippers, 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next like a child, hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand.
Excellent. Now, my first thought when I finished that book was, as a scientist, how long did you spend working out all of the time spans? Or did you just make them all up?
No, I did. I assumed an 80-year lifespan, and I made my best back-the-envelope calculation on it. What's funny is that an article in a German newspaper just came out that said Dr. David Eagleman has spent his career researching how people spend their lives, and they presented all these numbers as though it were real science. It's very odd.
That was great. Thanks for reading that. You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to neuroscientist David Eagleman. We've just been talking about some tales from the afterlife. And David, if we could perhaps look at your work as a neuroscientist in a bit more detail. Now, you're the director of the Eagleman Lab in Baylor College, Houston, Laboratory for Perception and Action, it's called. So what is tell us about some of the things that you research.
Essentially, what I research is how the brain constructs reality. So I do this at several levels. First, I study things like vision and time perception and how these things are constructions of your brain. So, you know, colors don't actually exist in the outside world. You just have electromagnetic radiation and your brain constructs these colors. But it goes a lot deeper than that. It turns out that essentially all of vision is a grand illusion constructed by your brain, and it can break in various ways. Also, you can have hallucinations when your brain isn't getting the proper input or the circuits aren't running correctly. It starts spinning off with its own activity. So I study how this works and how we get our sense of reality, and sort of the direction I've been going in for the last 10 years is about time perception. And this is a really new area. And it turns out that time is also a construction of the brain. And in my laboratory, we can make you believe that something took longer or shorter than it actually did, or that something happened before something else, even though it was the other way around. And it's a little spooky when you start reaching your hands down into this, and you find out that your sense of something as fundamental as time, it's not that you're just taking an accurate record of something flowing by in the outside world, it's that you're actually constructing it. And so this is giving us a new way of looking at certain mental disorders. Essentially, we're asking the question, well, what happens if your perception of time breaks?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the hypotheses we're pursuing right now is that schizophrenia fundamentally might be a disorder of time. Because if you're getting your timing wrong in the outside world, for example, when you reached out and did an action in the world and when you get sensory feedback, if you get that wrong, you have a very fragmented cognition. You have a very different interpretation of things. And one of the hallmark characteristics of schizophrenia is credit misattribution, where they will reach out and do something and then they'll say, well, that wasn't me. I didn't do that. And it's because they feel as though the urge to do the thing came after the thing actually happened. And so as a result of that deficit in timing, they do not take credit for it. And another example is auditory hallucinations, which characterizes schizophrenia. We are pursuing the hypothesis that, in fact, what's going on is that their brain is generating the voice and they're hearing the voice just like we always do. We always have an internal monologue. Except they're getting the order backwards, so they feel like they're hearing the voice before they are generating it. And you would have to attribute that to someone else's voice in your head. So it turns out this is a very fruitful direction, is trying to figure out how time is fundamentally represented in human brains and what happens when that goes wrong.
You've looked at time perception in high adrenaline scenarios, so what happens?
It's a very common report that time seems to slow down when people are in a life-threatening situation, like a car accident.
This is like, I'm reminded of, was it Einstein's thing, description of relativity, about the difference between, a second with your hand on a hot stove and a second talking to a pretty girl or something.
That's exactly right. But the thing is, because of the way that our models were evolving about time perception, I needed to know if this was true, if it actually could happen that you could be like Neo in the Matrix and see the world in slow motion during, let's say, a very scary, life-threatening situation. And it turns out this had never been tested. You can imagine it's quite difficult to figure out how to test this. So I spent a year working on a way to test it, and I finally came up with it. We dropped 23 people, one at a time, from a 150-foot-tall tower in free fall, and they were caught in a net below. So they're going 70 miles an hour when they hit the net. So it's a 3-second experiment. You have a person falling, and during the 3 seconds that they're falling to what feels like your death, we measure their time perception. And the way I did this is I built and patented a little device that we strap to their wrist. We call it the perceptual chronometer. And essentially, it flashes information at you in such a way that we can measure how fast your brain is taking in information. And the idea is, if you are seeing the world in slow motion like Neo, then you will be able to report very different numbers than if you are not able to. And so the other half of the experiment is we had people make duration estimates after the fall. We asked them to recreate on a stopwatch how long the fall took. So here's what we found. Retrospectively, people thought that it took a long time. In other words, they had a real duration distortion. They thought the event really took a long time. But they were not able to read the numbers. They were not able to see in slow motion. When we're actually measuring it during the event, they were not seeing anything in slow motion. They were not like Neo in the Matrix. And what this indicates is that a lot of time perception is a trick of memory. I mean, you have to consider memory in retrospective assessment when you're thinking about time. And so it turns out when you're in a really scary situation, memories get laid down differently, essentially a secondary track. And when you read that back out, you think, my God, that must have taken so long. I must have seen the whole thing in slow motion. But if we measure it during the event, you're not actually seeing it in slow motion.
Okay, well, let's look at another area that you're renowned for researching. This is the phenomenon of synesthesia, which is, well, you should probably tell us what that is, because a lot of people won't have
sure
heard, might have experienced it, but will not have necessarily know the term.
Right. So since I've been studying how the brain constructs reality, I got very interested in an area called synesthesia. So synesthesia is where you have a mixture of the senses. So you might hear music, and it causes you to physically see colors. It turns out it used to be thought that synesthesia was very rare. We now know it's extremely common. It's at least 1% of the population has synesthesia. And this comes in many forms. So a very common form is when you look at letters of the alphabet or numbers, that triggers a color experience. Or you might taste something and it makes you feel like you're feeling something with your fingertips. Or you might hear something and it makes you feel like there's a taste in your mouth. So essentially, in any cross-sensory blending you can imagine, somewhere one of us has found a case of this. So there are many different forms, and it's much more common than previously thought. And the idea with synesthesia is it's not just a made-up association. It's not just somebody acting poetic or metaphorical. It's actually a physical perception that results from slightly more crosstalk between neighboring areas in their brain. So, for example, if the areas that are involved in listening to music are next to the areas or nearby the areas that are encoding for color and shape and form, and if these are crosstalking a little bit more than normal brains, then hearing music causes you to actually perceive, it actually tickles those other areas so that you're perceiving colors and shapes and forms. So what my lab is doing is taking synesthesia from the genetics to the neuroimaging to the behavior. So it turns out that synesthesia is inherited. This was first noted in a paper in the journal Nature in 1880 by Sir Francis Galton, who said, it seems like synesthesia runs in family trees. Well, it turns out he was right, and nobody has pulled the gene for it, and that's what we're doing right now.
So just to reiterate that, so this is, it's a phenomenon that's not even recently been coined. I mean, it was known in its sort of present.
Well, here's the amazing thing about synesthesia. Just over 100 years ago, it was in the literature. There were papers in Science and in Nature, and it completely fell out of the spotlight for about a century. And the reason is the behaviorist school took over, where people said, you know, consciousness is not something we're even going to talk about. It's a taboo subject. We're just going to treat the brain like a black box with input and output. And so the whole issue of even trying to understand subjective reality completely was a taboo subject. And it was only really 20 years ago, people like Francis Crick, people with that kind of gravitas, who said, you know, consciousness is a real scientific problem, and it actually feels like something to have private subjective experience, and that's related to the brain, and we're going to figure out what the relationship is. So I was lucky that as a young man getting into neuroscience, it was right at the time that consciousness was making a new debut. And so something like synesthesia has just come back into the spotlight. And the truth is, I got into the synesthesia field about 8 years ago, and it was still pretty fuzzy, the science on it. Almost all the papers on it had a sample size of one. In other words, a case study. People would say, hey, we found a synesthete, and here's what she experiences, blah, blah, blah. But now that's really changed. So we have now, my lab has now analyzed over 5,000 synesthetes and rigorously phenotyped them and gotten their data and come to understand them. And so it's a different field even now than it was a few years ago.
I mentioned before that people might not necessarily have heard the term synesthesia, but may well be very familiar with, you know, the benefits, for want of a better word. Is people just presume this is normal, I suppose.
Precisely. So we all accept the reality presented to us. And so for people with synesthesia, it would never strike them that you and I don't see the world the same way they do. And so it's not until they hear a radio show or a podcast talking about synesthesia that they say, what? I thought everybody...
Doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah, thought that the number 3 was red and J is purple and so on. And it's because we all accept that reality. In the same way, if you were colorblind, it would never strike you that there's some other dimension you're missing. And here's an interesting one. We now know that at least 10% of women have a fourth type of photoreceptor in their retina, which means that they can see colors that you and I can't see, that we just can't experience. But of course, until this moment, when you learned that, you never felt like you were missing something. So that's the same thing with synesthesia. They experience their reality as they do, they would actually feel that our reality, if you're not a synesthete, is impoverished, because when we look at the number 3, there is no particular color or texture associated with it.
In what sort of ways would it be a benefit?
As far as we can tell, synesthesia is only advantageous and not disadvantageous. And one way it's beneficial is synesthetes tend to have better memory, and that's because they just have this free extra dimension that they can tie information with. So if I tell you that my number is 713-298-1825, if you're synesthetic, you will think, oh, it's got a nice autumn pattern to it. And then later, if you've sort of forgotten a little bit of the number, you might be able to reconstruct it because you've associated something exactly the way that it's easier for you to remember a poem if it's lyrics to music, mm-hmm. right? It's much easier that way because you've tagged it in an extra dimension. So synesthetes tend to have much better memories.
Okay, well, let's to finish, let's move on to something you will have done this by the time this interview goes out, but while you're in the UK, you're speaking at the RSA about neurolaw, which is something else that your lab is sort of investigating. So what does that mean? What is that concept?
So as I've been spending my time studying how brains construct reality, one of the areas of interest to me is how different brains do so differently. And really, as a neuroscientist, what I'm interested in the end is where does the rubber hit the road in terms of how neuroscience cashes out for society? And the area that happens in, I think, most is with what's going to happen with the legal system. So the legal system currently has the myth of equality, which is it treats all brains equal. And there's something called the reasonable man standard, which is pervasive in everybody's legal system, where essentially you ask, what would any reasonable man have done in this same situation? Well, the reason that's based on felonious grounds is because brains are not the same. Brains exist on a wide distribution. There are very different capacities for decision-making, different intelligence, and so on. And so not all brains are the same, so there is no sense in which we can talk about reasonable man. The second issue is it's predicated on this idea that we are what's called practical reasoners, meaning that we have free will and we get to make our own decisions. Well, it turns out that might not be such a great assumption either, because the more we understand about the unconscious brain, the more we understand that most of what you think and do and act and believe is generated by parts of your brain that you have no access to. And the conscious you is really not the one driving the boat. So when you take these two sort of basic lessons from neuroscience and then ask, well, what's going on with the legal system? You see that there's a real tension between neuroscience and the law. And where this sort of comes to a head is the number of legal cases where somebody commits some horrific crime, and then we find out retrospectively that that person had, let's say, a massive brain tumor, which has changed their behavior. Well, we have lots of cases like this where we know that brain tumors change people's behaviors. For example, there was just a case of a married man who became a pedophile, and his wife, who had known him for 20 years, said this is not like him at all. She took him to the doctor. They found out he had a massive frontal tumor. They resected the tumor. His sexual appetite went back to normal. About 6 months later, he started showing signs of pedophilia again. She took him back to the doctor. Turned out they missed a part of the tumor. They took that out. He was back to normal. So we have so many cases like this in the literature. We know that you are your biology. If your brain starts changing, you're going to change too. And in fact, one example of this is with Parkinson's medications. There's now a warning on the medications that this can lead to compulsive gambling, because it turns out that the neurotransmitters involved are not only those involved in Parkinson's, but also in the reward system and risk aversion. So the point is, when you change your biology, it changes you. It changes your decision-making and the way you act. Okay, so the question is, what does all this mean for culpability? Well, here's what it does and doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that we're going to let anybody off. I mean, we still have to take bad people off the street. So that part's not going to change. But as we get better biological explanation, it means that we're finally going to be heading an enlightened path where we can look at customized sentencing and customized rehabilitation. And these, I think, are things that are very important that neuroscience can make a contribution to. So with customized sentencing, we can look at really what is the probability that this person is going to reoffend, is going to recidivate. And we can start making better predictions based on what we know from neural signatures about what people's probability of recidivism is. But even more importantly, we can introduce new ideas for rehabilitation, which is something that hasn't been introduced in a very long time. One thing we're doing at Baylor College of Medicine, where I am, is we're using real-time feedback with neuroimaging. So imagine that you're lying in a scanner, and we're starting this with cigarette smokers, so I'll give you this example. So you're a cigarette addict, and you're trying to quit. So we show you pictures of people smoking cigarettes. That activates this network involved in craving in your brain. So what we do is we measure how active that network is, and we represent that as a bar on the screen. And your job is to make that bar go down. So you surf through your mental space, and you figure out whatever you need to do in order to be able to squelch your craving, to make that bar go down on the screen. And so it's feedback where you're getting a visual signal of how much activity is going on in that craving network in your brain. And by doing this, what we're trying to do is allow people to help themselves by strengthening up their impulse control. Because all cigarette smokers will tell you, I don't want to smoke, it's just that when I see that, I can't stop myself. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out this is true for most criminals as well. If you catch them in a moment of sobriety and cold reflection, they'll say, I do not want to be this type of person. I do not want to be a pedophile. It's just when I'm in the situation, I can't help myself. So what we're trying to do is allow people to strengthen up the parts of their brain involved in impulse control and long-term decision-making. And I think if this works, this will be a huge change. It means we won't have to change. It means we won't have to treat jail as a one-size-fits-all solution. But instead, we can do more customized things for the population. The difficulty with all this is figuring out what this means for our notions of culpability, which are very deeply inbred. When we think about somebody committed a crime and then you find out they have a brain tumor, and the question is, God, what do you do about that? How do you consider that?
I mean, especially with the example that you've used there, where you've talked about what society perceives as about the most serious crime you can commit.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the funny position we're in as a society. There are many things we can measure with our current neuroscience technologies. We can put people in MRI and we can measure if they have a big tumor. But this exists on a spectrum, and as you go to the other end of the spectrum, you find that we can't measure a lot of things because we just don't have tools to look at the microcircuitry and to figure out what drives people's behaviors at finer and finer levels of resolution. So this puts us in a funny situation in society where we sort of have this technological line, and to one side we say, oh, you know what, it wasn't really your fault. You had a massive tumor, and we're going to sort of treat you differently and give you some forgiveness for that, or, you know, work with you there. But if you're on the other side of the technology line, where we can't exactly measure what's different about your brain, then we say, you're in trouble. We're going to punish you and make you hurt because we don't have any sort of biological excuse for you. But the view of most neuroscientists at this point is you are your brain, and if you do some vastly abnormal behavior, it indicates there's something wrong with your brain, whether or not we can measure that currently. It indicates that there's something abnormal about your brain if your behavior is so vastly abnormal. And so that puts us in this very funny situation where it doesn't really make sense to ask the culpability question and say, oh, are you on this side of the line where it's not really your fault, it's your biology, or are you on this side where it's totally your fault? And what that recommends, I think, is getting rid of the culpability question altogether, just stopping asking that, and instead making the legal system purely forward-looking and saying, here's a brain in front of the judge's bench, and all we want to know is what happens from here. What's the probability that he's going to recidivate? Is there anything we can do to help him? Biologically, and you know, it's got to be all forward-looking instead of worrying about how much are we going to punish you based on how much is it your fault. That's the idea.
So, but presumably the biology, although an incredibly powerful part, is just one part of a person's makeup. There's their background, the culture they live in, for instance. I mean, to what extent would you ever be able to tell that it was solely the brain tumor was solely responsible for a person's behavior?
Yeah, it's a super question. The general story is when the brain ends up in front of the judge's bench, the exact circuitry and constitution of that brain is, of course, a very complicated combination of nature and nurture. So it's whatever the genetic predispositions were, plus whatever the neighborhood he grew up in, whether he was abused by his parents, whether he became addicted to drugs, all those things become what you see in front of the bench. There's no possibility of us untangling this. And as a result, the judge has to be forward-looking and say, you know, this brain's here, and I don't know if it was genetics, I don't know if it was his neighborhood and so on, but this is what we've got to do from here on out.
That's great. That's a thought-provoking point to leave it on. David, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye.